Sådär, hej och välkomna till Psyksmart.
Avsnitt 5.
Avsnitt 5. Idag ska vi prata om borderline. Borderline förkortas BPD, alltså Borderline Personality Disorder.
Men gör det även på svenska?
Det vet jag faktiskt inte. Jag brukar säga bara borderline.
Ja.
Och det är väl det de flesta gör.
Men vi kan ju tillägga att den här intervjun kommer att vara på engelska.
Precis.
Så därför kommer vi använda oss av förkortningen BPD när vi refererar till borderline personlighetsstörning.
Ja, vi ska nämligen intervjua Sofie Liljedahl som bland annat forskar vid Lunds universitet. Och hon är från Kanada från början. Så att vi kör den här intervjun på engelska helt enkelt och hoppas att ni alla hänger med och förstår. Vi ska klargöra, förutom den här BPD-termen, så vill vi också säga att DBT, alltså DBT, står för dialektisk beteendeterapi. Och det är den terapiformen som man tog fram från början, främst i borderline, som Sofie då jobbar med och forskar på. Och den... det verkar vara en väldigt bra terapiform,
ja,
tycker jag. Och den, man inser att man kan använda den till flera och flera saker.
Exakt, för jag tycker att det är väldigt mycket i den som är common sense. Men det är väldigt intressant att innan DBT kom som evidensbaserad forskning, så fanns det liksom inget sätt egentligen att bemöta borderline-patienter. Så det är...
Precis, och det är man kan säga det igen i det här fältet och när det kommer till diagnoser, att det är så himla, det är mycket som inte är så gammalt. Mm. Det är så här, jag fann att, och Sofie säger i intervjun att första varianten av DBT kom liksom 93 eller sånt där.
Ja, jag tror det var 93, precis.
Ja, vi får ju höra det sen, men det är ändå så här, det var inte så länge sedan man började förstå det här. Till sist vill vi också säga, evidensbaserat arbete nämner vi ju en hel del. Och för att göra det extra tydligt så bara evidens är liksom bevis. Så att det handlar då om att man gjort legitim forskning och sen fått fram fakta som man då utgår ifrån. Och inom psykologin är det väldigt så att man alltid ska utgå från evidensbaserat arbete. För att, och det är också så att evidensen kan förändras. För att med forskningen så lär man sig mer och man hittar en teori och sen så motbevisas den teorin.
Plus att det finns ny teknologi så man kan bevisa saker som man tidigare inte kunde bevisa.
Precis, när man snackar om neuropsykologi till exempel så finns det nu instrument som man inte kunde använda innan helt enkelt.
Ja. Så att... jag har en sista uppmaning bara så här innan vi sätter igång. Just att man säger, på svenska säger man borderline personlighetsstörning. Och jag skulle egentligen vilja uppmana till att använda borderline personlighetsvariation eller... eller något liknande som är lite mer neutralt. För jag tycker att det är så himla hårt att säga att någon har en personlighetsstörning. Det är konstigt.
Det blir liksom lite självuppfyllande profetia på den.
Ja,
att
precis.
Här, det är en störning. Ja. Det är alltså något fel på dig och det är inte något som går att ändra och sådär. När man faktiskt så här, det är så bra när man säger liksom att när man kan använda terapi i något sammanhang när terapin funkar, då är inte det här då är det inte obotligt. Och i och med att man funnit att DBT funkar på individer med borderline, så är ju inte borderline obotligt. Och det är så här väldigt skön tanke, tycker jag. Men med det sagt så kör vi igång nu och välkomna Sofie. Hi Sophie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my sincere pleasure.
And it's going to be interesting because we're going to do this in English. Because you're from Canada.
Indeed I am, yes.
And so we just hope that everyone would understand what we say. And yeah, if not, it's not that much we can do about it. So let's start. So could you start by just sharing your background with us?
Certainly. As you mentioned, I am from Canada. Despite the Swedish-sounding name, Sophie Isabelle is it's a name from the French-speaking province of Quebec, where I was born. So there is often a moment of startle when I'm not quite able to meet you in Swedish just yet. But it's a fun process to learn Swedish, and a little bit becomes accessible every day, which is lovely. So I completed my PhD and postdoctoral fellowship in clinical psychology within a scientist practitioner model of training. So in other words, I'm trained to be both a scientist and a clinician within the discipline of psychology. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in the province of Ontario, where I worked before moving to Sweden in 2012. And in Sweden, I work as the head of research, treatment, and program development, and as a psychology team leader at a residential treatment facility in Skåne called Finnegården. I also work as a lecturer and researcher at Lund University in the Department of Psychology, and I work at the Unit for Clinical Suicide Research at Lund University Hospital in Psychiatry Skåne.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. And may I ask how old you are? How do you have time for all this?
Oh,
maybe
goodness.
That's not an appropriate.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Answer. I'm 38. Yeah,
okay. So. Wow, still.
Time accumulates. You end up finding moments for things. And in Sweden, it's been a wonderful process. There's a really nice network here of Skåne of researchers and clinicians. So I think I've been quite lucky since getting here to be working on a few things that really matter a lot to me.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Because now, what's your research sort of right now with your research? Is it something special? Project or?
There's a few projects that I'm involved in right now. I'm working with Professor Martin Bohaus in Germany to bring to Sweden his specialized treatment of borderline personality disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder that treats the two disorders concurrently. So it's its own variant of dialectical behavior therapy called DBT-PTSD. And Professor Bohaus has some of the best outcome data in the world on residential treatment for BPD and PTSD. So unlike other treatments that combine working with trauma and BPD, the German model, it doesn't require that people stop self-harming prior to beginning to work on their trauma and therapy. So at the moment, we're translating his treatment manuals from German to English and then to Swedish, and he will be offering training in Sweden, hosted by Finnegården in May 2017. And there's a few other projects. Should I continue, or do you want to...
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's really interesting what you do, I think. Because, I mean, I've had you in some lectures, and you talked about self-harming, and you talked about depression and eating disorders, and it's quite... I thought about it because it's quite heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I mean, it seems quite heavy to work with it. But when you do it in research, maybe it's sort of... It motivates you in a different way.
I think it's a nice balance. The scientist practitioner model does allow you, I think, a certain freedom because, yes, it's you come into contact with people who are really suffering pretty unimaginably and profoundly for a long time. And I think it's easy to get frustrated sometimes as a clinician, never with the individual or not directed towards the individual, but sometimes things take a while and you can wonder, is this the very best treatment that we can be offering? I don't wonder that with evidence-based specialized treatments, but sometimes somebody has more than one primary, more than one principal diagnosis, and then how to work in an evidence-based way with more than one specialized protocol, that can be tricky. So I think what I like about being a researcher then is that you can go and have a look and see, okay, what does the literature say is available? What works best? What are the outcomes of pairing two different protocols within the same individual with similar characteristics? And then if you don't find an answer for what you're looking for, then there's the creative freedom to start your own investigation and to start testing your own intervention. Although it's very, with research, I would say, very much delayed gratification. It takes a long, long time. But I think, as you said, when you come into contact with a lot of suffering, that can be very motivating to try to find or co-create something specialized for that person. So
yeah.
That's motivating. Yeah, that gives energy.
Yeah, because it's quite common to have more than one diagnosis, right?
It can be. I think it depends on the setting where you work. So in a residential facility like Finnegården where I work, usually multiple comorbidities is sort of the norm. And that's good. We don't want to take anyone away from their life. So if someone can function on an outpatient basis, that's always the best. But if somebody is really, really overwhelmed and really, really cannot function because they have multiple principal co-diagnoses, then of course they need the support of a residential setting. So then it is quite normal to meet people who have rather a lot,
mm-hmm.
yeah, in terms diagnostically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. isn't it hard when you have several diagnoses that you might have, well, not really symptoms, but how to treat them that are sort of pitted against each other? Is it sometimes that you should act in this way when you have PTSD, and then if you have ADD at the same time, you shouldn't do this? Sort of like, you know, if, when you give someone medicine, they can sort of clash out on each other.
I know what you mean. I think I can speak from the perspective of borderline personality disorder, which is the, and dialectical behavior therapy, which is my principal therapeutic orientation, DBT, and followed by CBT. I mean, DBT is the cognitive behavioral therapy of borderline personality disorder, so they're very much hand-in-hand treatments. So with borderline personality disorder, I mean, it was a treatment developed for, and I'm putting this in finger quotes, multi-problem individuals. I mean, who wants to be called that on the one hand? On the other hand, if you have an individual whose suffering is so profound that they have a lot of escape behaviors, it can look like an eating disorder, it can look like substance abuse, it can look like, I mean, if someone has a lot of trauma and they're dissociating, that can look like ADHD. So I think a lot of the facilities, certainly where we work and a lot of the DBT teams, the first step is a really comprehensive diagnosis so that we can confirm previous, if there's like numerous and sort of question mark diagnosis in terms of the person not really recognizing that in their self-presentation, doing a really, really thorough intake assessment of axis one, that's all the clinical syndromes, and axis two, that's personality functioning, although in DSM there is no axes. However, many of us still use that that diagnostic system from DSM-4. Then you can really sort of look at current functioning and see whether there is a diagnosis that would explain rather a few different presentations, such as borderline personality disorder. Because, you don't want to get in a situation where you're chasing various behaviors, and both you and the person in therapy are going to be doing a lot of work and perhaps not getting at the core of what's driving all of these other behaviors. So I think really careful assessment at the beginning of therapy can clarify things, certainly. Yeah.
Because, I mean, that could be like a really mixed up thing when you have symptoms that will say that you have an eating disorder, but that it might actually come from borderline and not just something that happened to you or something that developed an eating disorder. So could it sort of be that borderline, that you get an eating disorder because of the anxiety around borderline?
It's a great question. You can certainly meet somebody who at the beginning of therapy looks like they're principally eating disordered, and then usually you would do this assessment and get a pretty good history of how long the different problems have started. And in my experience, usually if the eating disorder predates problems with emotion dysregulation, which are more typical of borderline personality disorder, then sometimes like the, as I said, my principal theoretical orientation is one that brings me to using dialectical behavior therapy as the intervention of choice for borderline personality disorder. And so when you're trying to understand what's driving the behavior, if somebody had an eating disorder for like many, many years that predated emotion dysregulation, I would have the hypothesis that maybe that eating disorder will pop up again once things simmer down, because that's how the person was managing their distress before they had difficulties with the symptoms that would give them the diagnosis of BPD. But sometimes when you're first meeting a person in therapy and it looks really eating disordered, once, if there's other things going on too, like self-harm and substance abuse and sort of other impulsive behaviors with the potential to become self-damaging, once you start teaching skills, so distress tolerance, emotion regulation skills, interpersonal effectiveness skills, and mindfulness skills, everything often starts to settle down. And when you see that people are responding really, really well to DBT, then you can, and the onset of the eating disorder was around the time that the onset of all the other difficulties coalesced, then usually DBT is sufficient to work with those different behavioral expressions, because it's all stemming from a person's pain, of course.
Yeah. And it's a lot of pain.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. We're going to go back, because we sort of skipped a couple of steps here.
Sure.
in my eagerness for answers. But if we just go back to borderline mm-hmm. personality disorder and BBT, as you say, it'll be DT.
I know, it's a lot of acronyms.
No, DBT is the therapy.
Yeah.
And BPD? Yes, thank you. BPD. That's borderline personality disorder.
I'm
just
so impressed that you're doing this in your non-native language. Like, it's a tongue twister in English, and I'm trying to imagine getting to a place where I could do this in Swedish, so you have my deepest
respect.
Yeah,
it's a lot of letters.
Yeah, I just stumble on the words sometimes, but we try. But yeah, BPD.
Yep.
Is it a lifelong condition?
These are really thoughtful questions. I have to say that, and they're good ones, they're ones that come up all the time. So BPD tends to have its onset during adolescence or early adulthood, and it tends to remit or become less apparent in later life. So untreated, it can persist a lot longer, like any clinical syndrome that goes without treatment. And I think that a number of decades ago, when there were no evidence-based treatments for BPD, the expected outcomes for individuals with the disorder was poor. But due to treatment developments within the last few decades, there's every reason to expect a good outcome for those who get specialized evidence-based treatment today. I will say I believe it's vital that individuals with BPD get treatment as soon as the illness is apparent, and this is due to the risk of completing suicide, which occurs in 10% of those diagnosed with BPD. A suicide that high is 50 times higher than the general population, which is why I emphasize timely, specialized, evidence-based treatment for those who have the diagnosis. Untreated BPD can persist for years of suffering for the individual, although the symptoms of BPD, as I mentioned, they tend to become less apparent in later life.
Yeah. Well, that's 50 times higher
than the general population.
That's insanely high. We mentioned in our earlier interview with Rebecca mm-hmm. with BPD, that it's sort of, we heard the term that it's like as if you have no skin as a person emotionally, sort of.
Yeah,
like
I think
you're so sensitive for everything, so everything, all your input is so much stronger.
There is that emotional sensitivity. I mean, we don't have time to get into it today, but the sort of the etiological model or the explanatory theory of how BPD is of how it begins and how it's maintained really looks at two things, and one is this extremely sensitive temperament on the one side, and an invalidating environment is the on the other side, and the two tend to transact over time in a way that keeps the person sort of in a heightened level of arousal always. Like, if you can imagine having a very sensitive temperament, which, you know, has some genetic basis, and you just throughout your lifetime you would be the kind of person who is upset a little bit more easily than others and takes a little bit longer to come back down to baseline. So a little more prone to heightened emotional arousal, which is neither here nor there. That's fine. That's a lot of people. That's most people who are therapists, too. You kind of need that sensitivity to be able to work closely with people. And sensitivity, I would say, it can be your greatest strength or your greatest weakness. It can also make you attuned to people and help you to understand people and feel what people are feeling. It's certainly not a curse. However, when you have that sensitive temperament, what combined for some time, sometimes years, with this invalidating environment, one that blames the person for their difficulties, that tells the person that their experience, that not only do they interpret their suffering as incorrect, but that it's their fault and that they're to cause. And there's invalidation has different levels and different things that maintain it. But what it does is produce distress that is more than what a person can contain. And that's what we talk about when we talk about emotion dysregulation. It's not being upset. It's not being angry. You can be perfectly angry or upset and quite regulated. It's when the emotion can't be contained anymore, when it escalates to a place where a person feels out of control. That's what we mean by emotion dysregulation. And if you can imagine being in an invalidating environment versus a validating environment, like probably we can all imagine someone we love being just beside themselves, distressed. And usually the impulse is to rush in and try to contain that person, to validate, to support, to help them to bring down their arousal. And that's exactly what validation does. It helps people's arousal come down. Or if you're in an environment where, you know, if you're dysregulated, that sort of looks at you and says, you know, get yourself together, or some invalidating response that invites further dysregulation, that keeps the emotional arousal high, that person is not getting a break, that person is getting further invalidation. And so the dysregulation continues. The likelihood of doing or saying something self-invalidating is rather high, because nobody is giving you an opportunity to have an accurate expression of your pain, and around it goes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even just describing it, if you can try to put yourself in the middle of that storm, yeah, that's a very unique kind of suffering. And unfortunately for individuals with BPD, this can be everyday life.
Could you give us an example of validation? What would you say to validate someone's pain or suffering?
Sure. I mean, and this is a dialectical behavior therapy, I'll say, from the beginning, I'm biased towards it because I've seen it work. And that said, it has its own flavor, which means that there's certain language and there's certain levels and there's acronyms. All of that really helps people to remember it in moments of high distress. So people might have a certain initial reaction to some of the levels or some of the language, but I think that Professor Linehan had in mind that it's very hard to recall information when we're dysregulated, and how to make it easy is to give it levels and to give it acronyms. So in that way, validation, there's six different levels that therapists are taught pretty quickly about how to meet a person to validate them in a way, because we can all have our ideas about what's validating, and it's like, but does the person experience that as validating? So for one person, might really be reassured by hearing that it's okay, and another person might be hearing that as an instruction, oh, I need to think it's okay now, right? So we tend to sort of steer away from telling people how to feel, and more like the first level of validation is appearing interested. And that's exactly the way we're looking at each other now: eye contact, nodding, engagement, sort of leaning forward a little bit, appearing interested, given that oftentimes it's really sad, but a lot of rejection that happens for people who have BPD, who are met by others who don't understand them. So appearing interested, accurately reflecting back what I'm hearing you say. So I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm hearing you, and I'm able to accurately reflect back to you what it is that you're saying. In certain cases, maybe anticipating, if I know you well, I might be able to sort of read you a little bit. Like, it sounds like you're feeling just awful, for example, if you've been basically telling me that you've been feeling awful. Helping people to understand that you see the present moment as understandable because of everything that came before. So even if somebody sort of had an outburst that they're later ashamed of, you communicate that you understand why that outburst happened because of everything that came before. You know, like, nobody has an outburst for no reason. And then also explaining to a person that it really, really makes sense to you. Finding, of course, what it is in the situation if they're in a moment of dysregulation, as they're describing to you what happened, you're searching for the part. Even if it looks, if there's like a lot of behavior going on and there's some things that don't make sense, you're searching for the thing that does make sense, that you can validate and reflect that it makes sense. Because, of course, I mean, I think that it's not a uniquely borderline experience to sometimes have emotional responses that might not look like they make a ton of sense. But if somebody cares for you enough to bear with you and hear for the part that does make sense, when they're able to reflect that to you, it's very reassuring, especially if people have been telling you for some time that you don't make sense, or you look a certain way that is not coherent to them. And then the final level of validation is being radically authentic, and that's treating people like people, not treating people like patients. That's being 100% yourself. That's not sugarcoating or fragilizing or tiptoeing around. That's being just completely you with a person. And it's often the case that folks with BPD don't get a lot of radical authenticity in their lives. They might get the sense that people are communicating things behind their back that are different than what would be said to them directly, which, again, this is not doing much to reduce emotional arousal if it's heightened in the first place. So being radically authentic in your interactions, it's super important. I tend to steer away from the word patient, actually, for that reason.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, because I think that the word patient can give a reaction to the actual patient or
client. To the person.
To the person that you're talking to.
Exactly. And for me, like in radical authentic communications, I'm not classifying people. It's just, we're here together.
I'm just thinking all of the things you're saying is super important for anyone working with people, I think. It's just fascinating to get words stuck to it, because this is probably things that some people have thought, or that we know how to confirm people, but we don't do it as often as we should.
And that's... When I was putting my thoughts together for our meeting this morning, and that's the thought I kept having. It's like this, yes, this is a specialized way to work with borderline individuals, and how is this any different than what you would hope for if you were really upset, or your friend was really upset, or your mom, you know, was really upset? Wouldn't you hope that someone would meet them in a really authentic way and work with them to help them reduce their emotional arousal and be validating and hear them and reflect that you hear them? Like, it is exactly, as you say, it's common sense. And what I love about Professor Linehan, she's the creator of dialectical behavior therapy, about her treatment is that it's quite a standardized way, so that we don't get into doing interpretations of what we think is validating, which might actually be pretty invalidating for somebody else.
But it's so applicable. I don't know if you can use that word. Yeah. You can really apply it to everyone. And I was thinking when you said that when a person doesn't make sense, you know, when there's so much many emotions and everything, and I was just thinking, well, you know, I don't always make sense either, even if I don't have
I mean, kind of like anyone who's really upset.
Yeah, we don't always make sense, and that's fine, you know.
Exactly.
But I was thinking about the term that we were discussing the symptoms a little bit on the phone before, and we were talking about this term manipulation.
Yes.
As a symptom of borderline.
So I would say that's another really, it's an unfortunate mistake. It's an error, I would say, to understand borderline individuals as manipulative. I would say that, in DBT, we really, giving the benefit of the doubt is part of the instructions within the therapy. And the reason for that is that we wouldn't understand someone with BPD as being manipulative. Rather, we would expect that most anyone in a desperate situation due to prolonged and acute distress might try desperate things to get the help that they need, especially if being less desperate hasn't been successful, like if people have been ignored or if people have been turned away when they were acting in a less extreme way, and they were, didn't get what they needed. But if they start to behave in an extreme way, then people see them. That's kind of reinforcing, right? So it's more the environment that's shaping the person to be extreme or to have behaviors that might be classified as manipulative than being driven by manipulation per se. So we really do not understand the motivation to be manipulative at all. Usually once people get the help that they need, that behavior stops right away. So that wouldn't be the case if it was manipulation.
And I'm thinking also that telling someone implying that someone is manipulative, that's the exact opposite of confirming their feelings or verification. Validating. Yeah.
Exactly.
But that's unfortunately, it's kind of used as an argument not to listen to the person. Like, oh, well, I can't believe you. I can't listen to what you're saying about yourself, because you're manipulative, because you have bipolar disorder. Borderline.
And it's such a funny thing. Like, really, when we take a look at, like, learning and behavior and behavioral theory, we can't ever know the motivation of another person. All we can really know is their behavior, what they show us, and everything else is an inference. So you can have, that's what we mean about benign interpretations and giving the person the benefit of the doubt. Because I cannot actually reach in and access, nobody can, somebody else's internal working models, we have to go on behavior. That's what we can see, that's what's verifiable, that's what we can talk about. It doesn't make sense to me to brand someone with this label that you can't. I mean, the other side of it is, can you prove that? It's to me a little bit circular. Can you prove that someone is being manipulative? No. Can you prove that they're not being manipulative? No. So, like, how would you verify that? It just seems like if we're talking about invalidation being the thing that keeps emotional arousal high and increases the likelihood of dysregulation, that would be part of the mix.
We were talking about, you mentioned DSM before, DSM-4 and DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, because you said there's been a transition, because now we use DSM-5, which is the manual, the diagnostic manual for, well, how would you say, psychological disorders? Or
the APA, American Psychiatric Association, has created this classification system, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Usually people stop there. I think that disease might be further on, and that might be why.
Exactly. But so I was sort of wondering, when it comes to this, how do you get the diagnosis?
Yeah, so today the diagnosis would be conferred by a psychologist or a psychiatrist after having conducted a formal standardized clinical assessment of personality functioning. And the assessment interview is consistent with the formulation of personality disorders developed by the DSM, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or the International Classification of Diseases, so the ICD. So I'd say it's pretty important to make sure that it is a structured clinical interview as opposed to other ways that people might use to diagnose that would be less formal. I think something like a personality disorder is, it's a rather significant diagnosis, so doing a structured formal clinical interview, that's the gold star in terms of assessment.
And I mean, DSM is evidence-based, so it's something that we can trust, I guess. That's the thing, because I'm coming, there's just a question afterwards, because I'm thinking that it's always an interpretation.
Yes.
And you have these criterias that someone's supposed to meet, and if you just press the, there are these 10 or something criterias, and this is the same, sort of, right, that you're meeting criterias of symptoms, and there's always the person that has to assess the person that you're assessing to see if, you know, can we tick off these boxes? Do you have this and this and that?
You raise, again, Karen, this is, I mean, and we talk about this in class too, that diagnoses are, that they're not real in the way that something in the physical world is real. So they're umbrella terms to describe clusters of symptoms. And I think whenever you communicate a diagnosis, it's really important to communicate that, that this is not who you are. It's not something that doesn't change. And it's not something that isn't vulnerable to error. We can see that in the DSM, like the original DSM that was very, very little. To some very unpopular and politically incorrect variants in the DSM that have since been removed to where the DSM now is. It's like anything in science, it's iterative, it's self-correcting, and it changes. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to explain to people when you're communicating a diagnosis of a mental illness exactly what the diagnosis means and what it doesn't mean. And what it doesn't mean is that this is a lifetime thing, and it doesn't mean that this is who you are. And it doesn't mean that it would explain your identity any better than what your interests are, what your hobbies are, what you love and what you're passionate about. It's a component of your functioning today in the best way that we can describe it today. I would say nothing more. Yeah.
Nicely put. I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When do people typically get their diagnosis within BPD?
Yeah, I'm thinking there's a really lovely review paper for, and it's getting on in years. It was 2004, published in The Lancet, that talked, I think it was, that the average person with borderline personality disorder has, I think, something like 6 contacts with the mental health system before getting an accurate diagnosis, and then I'm not sure how long before getting specialized treatment. So that was more than 10 years ago, and I hope it's gotten better. That would be an interesting study to do, especially regionally, because I think, like here in Sweden, there's quite a bit more publicly funded DBT with more family programs because of the socialized healthcare system here than there is in some regions of North America. Certainly some cities that I've lived in North America, there's less there. Even though it's an English language treatment that originated there. So probably a really interesting study would be to take a look at the latency between symptom onset, accurate diagnosis, and treatment by region. It's a great research question.
Yeah. But so how would we, if someone is listening and they have, well, PPD, or they think that, well, they have a lot of problem anyway and they need help here in Sweden, how does one get the help one need? Is it a, because we met this girl, Rebecca, that we mentioned and in the previous interview, that hasn't gotten any help at all. I mean, she didn't do DBT. She never went to a therapist.
Mm.
And that's in the Swedish system. And she's been at the emergency room, like booked for psychiatric emergency room several times. And they just sort of gave her pills to send her home.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, those stories, I guess, will always be found. But it seems that there are several stories like these in Sweden, unfortunately, even if we have such good healthcare.
It's tricky. Of course, I can't comment on her particular situation. But what I can say, for a referral, and it does vary depending where you are, of course. But my understanding here is that you need a doctor or a social secretary to give you a referral. To get the ball rolling, people who would like DBT can call the Virksomhet chef or the contact person of your local DBT team. And DBT Scandinavia has published a list with contact information for a number of teams on their website.
Okay. So you can just call them and say that you...
I think that can help to get the ball rolling. Right. I mean, I would say it might be a struggle to get the services that you need, but my advice would be to continue to advocate for your health and well-being. Because my understanding is that here in Sweden, you have the actual right to have treatment. So don't be discouraged if it doesn't come easily or right away. But my hope, of course, is that it does.
Yeah. So DBT Scandinavia.
Yeah. That's the Scandinavian organization that sort of has a role in organizing the efforts and communications and training about DBT in Sweden and in Denmark. So if you just Google DBT Scandinavia, there's a mapping project recently that described the different, not all of them, but a number of different DBT teams by region, and then there's a contact number there. So that would be a place to start getting the ball rolling. My understanding is that you also do, of course, need a doctor or social secretary. But if that's not happening for you, you can still make some efforts to make it happen for yourself. Yeah.
So is DBT used for anything else than BPD?
Yes. Yes, in fact, the original therapy manuals were published in 1993. And at that time, a therapy that is researched to test its efficacy along the way. For a long time, I would say even until like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, since there was another updated version of the DBT manuals, I think in 2014 that was published by Linehan and her group. So up until then, we were all very cautious not to use DBT outside of what it was prescribed. Like, I mean, it's indicated for people who have BPD. And sometimes I think you could make the argument of using it for people clinically who maybe don't meet the full diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder, but who have difficulties with emotion regulation. So I've used DBT. I've used not the whole... I would say you can. It was DBT-informed therapy with a person who has substance use disorder that's driven by emotion dysregulation. That was effective for that person because really he was getting high because he had a lot of emotion dysregulation. And in that case, we'd have to be careful to call it DBT-informed therapy because it's not the whole shebang. But in the more recent second edition of DBT manual, there's numerous different curricula of DBT skills that you can tailor your program to. So now there's a curriculum that includes skills for people who have addiction. So when the crisis is addiction, then DBT skills specialize to that. Because the finding, I think a number of people, like me clinically, would be meeting people who had principally difficulties with emotion dysregulation, or not principally, they didn't meet diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder, but the behaviors were keeping them from living a fulfilled life. Mm-hmm. And so that DBT-informed therapy, you can now do in a more consistently DBT way based on the new on the new manual.
So are you seeing in the future that this could be adopted to a lot of other diagnoses?
Absolutely. There's so much in DBT. It's really, it's a really multi-component therapy, and there's a lot that would work well and does work well for other areas. I mean, that's what we, the original formulation of dialectical behavior therapy for, again, here are the finger quotes, multi-problem individuals, is that usually there is more than just emotion dysregulation. Usually there's self-harm and eating sort of disordered behaviors, and sometimes there's addictions or substance abuse. Mm-hmm. So how to create a, that's the wonderful thing about DBT, we create a sort of a treatment targets, with staying alive being the most important thing, and then sort of working from that with the person to get their life contained and on track, instead of going down various avenues trying to chase different behaviors that probably just wears everybody out and maybe doesn't get into the kind of transformative change that you see with DBT when treatment is structured based on therapy targets.
Yeah, because shortly to explain how DBT works, I mean, because what I've learned, and I've only read very, very little about DBT, but it's that you sort of go in from all these different angles, and you have sort of, there's so much more, I don't know, time and effort around the therapy than it would be around maybe CBT or PTD. It is.
PTSD?
No. What's it called? The other, there are three big...
Psychodynamic therapy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't say PDT. Psychodynamic therapy. Anyways, but those two forms, that DBT is sort of more intense in a way.
It's definitely multimodal. It covers the bases for sure. So the standard outpatient manualized form of DBT has four components: individual therapy, group skills training, a DBT crisis line for skills coaching in the moment, and the consultation team. So in individual therapy, that's really focused on teaching people with BPD how to use the DBT skills in their lives, as well as to keep them in therapy. So in other words, to help them to stay motivated. Then DBT skills training group is just what it sounds like. It's a weekly group that's like a class, a skills trainer that teaches DBT skills and assigns them for a practice over the coming week. Then the DBT crisis line coaching line is a chance for individuals receiving DBT to get on-the-spot skills coaching in situations that they would have typically used to self-harm or use other self-destructive or impulsive behaviors as a way to manage their symptoms before DBT. So if we're asking people to stop those behaviors, we don't just ask people to stop without giving them a way to help them stop, because if they could just stop, they would have. So the idea is that if they're struggling in the moment, in a moment where they would have, say, for example, used self-harm, then they're welcome to call their therapist before they self-harm and find a new, a more skillful way to deal with their situation that doesn't involve a self-destructive behavior. So as long as folks call before they self-harm, then they're welcome to use that skills coaching line 24 hours a day.
So you could actually get in contact with your therapist at any time?
That's right. Yeah. And then finally, there's the DBT consultation team, which gives the therapist support to be effective in their work. How to stay non-judgmental if somebody, if you have a number of clients and you feel depleted, how to get support as a therapist, how to remain that the dialectical sort of position of being able to see both your position and the others together, as well as maintaining all of the assumptions of DBT, like people are doing the best that they can, for example.
Because it must be challenging to work with DBT. I mean, I would say now, and because I'm not finished, I'm not a psychologist, but to have people call you on a daily basis saying that I'm about to self-harm, help me, and then you help them, and hopefully they won't self-harm, but you never know, because when you hang up the phone, it's still sort of, hopefully you've helped, but you're not sure, and I mean...
I would say that having a DBT skills coaching line, I would say it's probably easier than having one of these hotlines that people call, because you have a relationship. You have a relationship with the person who's in DBT.
Yeah.
So sometimes it can be a little bit, it can take a bit of energy at the beginning of therapy. On the one hand, on the other hand, I would always much rather that people call. Please call instead of not calling if you need help, right? So at the beginning of therapy, I expect, and people do tend to call quite a bit because they don't know the skills yet and they don't know what they should be doing instead. So that's doing a good job in DBT, is to be that's being skillful. Yeah. And then when people tend to learn more skills, they tend to need the crisis line less, unless there's something really big going on. And then for sure, you're working closely with this person, you would want to be able to support them in that if it's risking their progress in their therapy. It's much better that they can reach you and get some in-the-moment skills coaching. And usually what you would say, like you would brainstorm together about how to use other behaviors and skills in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then there's always the invitation, if it doesn't work, call me back in an hour. And that's the way you can sort of not be waiting and wondering for the rest of the night. And sometimes people do, mostly people don't. It's a relationship that they're in with you too. So usually if you explain the parameters, like it's not, people can't call and just refuse help, for example, and they can't call if they have already self-harmed. There's some parameters of using the skills coaching line effectively. And then usually people, they build it into the repertoire, and then usually by the end of, towards the, like in the second phase of treatment or after people have been through the first round of skills once, usually they notice that by the time the urge to pick up the phone calls happens, they're already behaving skillfully because they've already turned to another behavior than self-harm as their first response. So once usually they realize that, then they need less and less telephone support.
Yeah. So I'm thinking for a regular therapist, it must be kind of frustrating that you can only have your scheduled meeting. You can't give them your phone number. You can't keep in contact. You can say, call me if it's bad. Kind of, because they have their tight schedule and stuff. I think that would be...
That was going through my mind when you had mentioned that it must be difficult to do DBT. Yeah. I would say it's more difficult to not have the tools to be able to help someone in the way that they need and to see them suffering while they're in therapy with you and to have the sense that you're not doing everything you can. I think that would be harder.
Yeah, that's true. I get that. We sort of are running out of time, so we have to, and it sucks because this is so interesting and I would love to talk about this forever, but if we could just wrap this up with our last question.
Yeah.
And it's, if someone's listening who's never encountered a person with borderline, is there anything you could say to help them sort of understand them better, or, I mean, to not let their prejudice about the diagnosis affect their judgment?
Yes, yeah. I would say, and we've touched on some of these things already, that people who have BPD, like anyone who's in a lot of distress, can be helped to reduce their emotional arousal and distress by being met with a validating response, and bemötande, which is such a great word, which we don't have in English. So you don't have to be a professional to be validating. Usually people's emotional arousal is reduced if they feel validated and understood, and that's true for everyone, not just people with BPD. So in a nutshell, I would say to be validating, to interpret behavior benignly, to give the benefit of a doubt. And you also, of course, you have to be kind. And in return, you'll meet some of the loveliest people you could ever hope to meet.
Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you.
This has been super interesting. I'm so happy.
I've really enjoyed meeting you this morning as well. I think that this is a lovely thing that you're doing in your free time. So I'm very pleased to contribute.
Sådär, nu har ni hört oss snacka engelska en stund. Och förhoppningsvis hängt med på Sofies förklaringar och fakta. Vi satt ju helt trollbundna när ni skulle sett oss.
Vi satt med öppna munnar.
Och mickade och bara berätta mer. Därav att det här blir ett helt eget avsnitt, för att vi bara, hon har så mycket bra att säga, den här kvinnan.
Och vi vill helt enkelt inte klippa ner det här, för det är väldigt kärnfullt på något sätt.
Ja.
Och jag hoppas att även om det tidvis kanske går lite fort, att man ändå kan ta till sig utav engelskan.
Ja, absolut. Jag tänkte verkligen på det, för jag har varit lite så här, vad vill jag jobba med som färdig psykolog? Och jag tänkte att shit, jag kommer inte orka jobba med för tunga diagnoser så som borderline. Och så här, DBT som är en väldigt så här, det är en terapiform som ger så mycket och har så mycket liksom resurser om man jämför med så här KBT. Men nu när jag har Sofie är det så här, men det är ju fantastiskt att det är så mycket, att när man har pratat med en klient så är det inte bara, ja men då ses jag om en vecka igen i en timme, utan de kan ringa om man har en liksom
större kontakt eller typ något sätt större förmåga att hjälpa. Och det är ju någonting som, så länge man får ett bra stöd av sin egen handledare som psykolog, så tror jag att det är jättefint och givande att jobba på det här sättet.
Ja, och jag tror verkligen på det, för att att jobba som psykolog och ha det som roll liksom en gång i veckan, det är inte, det är inte så att människor funkar. Människor plockar inte bara fram känslor en gång i veckan, utan det kan komma lite när som. Och jag tycker att det här är en grej där man anpassar systemet efter individen istället för tvärtom. Och jag verkligen, jag hyllar den utvecklingen. Verkligen.
Mm. Ja, för jag känner väl det så här. Jag har tänkt på det när man går i terapi och sådär. Nu har jag en timme som man betalar för. Och det är dyrt att gå i terapi. Så nu måste jag verkligen make it count.
Eller hur? Samla på känslorna liksom. Ja. Stoppa dem i en burk och plocka fram dem.
Precis. Och då, försöka liksom. Bara så här, säga rätt saker. Kom ihåg det här och... Så det är en press i det alltså.
Mm.
Och med DBT så är det ju inte alls den grejen, utan det finns ett annat utrymme att bara så här, idag känner jag för att vara sluten och jag klarar inte av så mycket, jag kan bara vara här och det får ta tid liksom.
Det, men det är också säkerligen ett väldigt kostsamt och liksom tidskrävande. Jag vet att det är väldigt lång väntetid också för DBT, men man förstår ju att det är förunnat de som absolut svårast.
Så. Men förhoppningsvis på sikt så får man ju upp mer ögonen.
Ja, att man kan jobba på det här sättet även med andra problem.
Precis.
Jag tror så mycket på det.
Precis, och fina med det om missbrukare och att man kan få hjälp med det. Man kan forma DBT lite olika beroende på vem det är. Och just det här grejen att du kan utgå från DBT men så kan du göra lite annorlunda. Och att just få den här individsanpassningen är så himla viktigt, och det är ju verkligen på väg.
Mm.
Om man ser på den som nuvarande nutida forskning och sådär.
Så
ja, det här var skitspännande.
Mm.
Och vi ville typ inte sluta.
Ja, men jag vill också tipsa om att lyssna på nästa avsnitt nu som kommer. För då har vi en tjej som heter Rebecca som berättar om hur det är att ha borderline personlighetsvariant.
Ja, och då får höra just det här. Här är ett exempel på hur det kan vara och kännas och vad hon har upplevt och gått igenom och hur hon tänker helt enkelt. Mm. För det är någonting som vi inte kan ge genom fakta och våra egna tankar.
Nej.
Men tack vare henne får vi hennes perspektiv.
Mm. Hon har en sjukt gripande historia.
Mm.
Så lyssna på det.
Men då vill vi tacka Sofie Liljedahl igen då. För idag.
Ja, stort tack.
Ja, och Remila Vass, producenten.
Mm-hmm, som klipper ihop det här.
Dömmen. Ja, henne är grym. Och helt enkelt hoppas att ni tyckte om det.
Ja, och om ni tycker om det så får ni jättegärna gå och ge oss en rating på iTunes. Så fler kan komma åt eller se podden helt enkelt.
Eller dela den på Facebook eller bara berätta om den. Ja. Bara börja prata om det här mer. Diskutera det. Det är så himla... Jag tycker det är så himla intressant. För det är bara så här... Gud, vilken variation vi människor har. Inte bara så här utseende, var vi kommer ifrån, allt det där. Utan våra inre... Vår inre sida är så himla... Alla är så himla olika och det är så himla spännande.
Jättespännande. Ja. Tack för oss idag. Och lyssna på oss igen.
Hejdå!
Hejdå!